swallowed hard and quick and choked it back. The heavy breathing made her sweat. I need some air, please. I'm suffocating.
That's one of my favorite words.
He stepped over, leaned down to her face, and yanked off the hood. Jerry gawked at the pale mask with the pockmarks and scars and screamed. Then she gagged and retched and vomited on the floor. When she finished, he gently reached behind her and unlocked the handcuffs. She pulled her hands free and shook her arms as if to get the blood moving. Thanks, asshole, she said. He walked to the fireplace to a stack of office files, which he slowly tossed one by one into the flames. Can I have some water? She asked. He nodded to a bottle next to a lamp. She grabbed it and took a drink, trying not to look at him. He ignored her as he burned the files. The room was dark, shades pulled down, quilts over the two windows, not a shred of sunlight anywhere. The ceiling was low. The walls were perfect logs with white plaster between them. On a coffee table, there was a coil of nylon rope, yards of it, blue and white in color, with two strands cut off, all on display for her to gawk at. Where are we? She asked. And do you think I'll answer that? No. Take the mask off, Bannock. I know who you are. I recognize your voice. Have we met? No, thank God, not until now. I saw you on stage. Death of a Salesman. How long have you stalked me? 20 years. How did you find me? How did you find me? You made some stupid mistakes. So did you. My ankles and legs are numb. Too bad. You're lucky to be alive. So are you. I thought about killing you years ago. He was amused by this and sat on the stool in front of her. She couldn't bear to look at his mask and instead stared at the fire. Her breathing was still heavy and her heart felt like a jackhammer. Had she not been so terrified, she would have cursed herself for being stupid enough to get caught by the man she had hated for decades. She needed to vomit again. Why didn't you kill me? He asked. Because you're not worth prison, and I'm not a killer. It's an art when done properly. You should know. Oh, I do. Am I next? I don't know. He slowly stood, peeled off the mask, and tossed it in the fire, then added some more office files to it. He returned to the stool in front of her, their knees almost touching. Why haven't you killed me yet, Bannock? I would be what, number 9, 10, 11? At least. Why should I tell you? So, I missed a couple. A wave rolled through her and she grimaced as she choked it down. She closed her eyes to avoid his stare. He walked back to the stack of files on the firewood rack, took several and slowly tossed them into the flames. She wanted to ask what he was burning, but it didn't concern her. Nothing mattered but staying alive, though that looked doubtful. Her thoughts flashed to Denise, the only person on the planet who would miss her. He returned to the stool and stared at her. I have a couple of choices, Ms. Crosby. Oh, please, don't show me any respect. I don't want yours. Let's stick with Jerry and Bannock, okay? The more you talk, the better your chances, because I want to know what you know, and more importantly, I want to know what the cops know. I can leave, Jerry, vanish into thin air and never be seen again. How much have you told Lacey Stoltz? Leave her out of it. Oh, really? That's an odd thing to say. You went to her with your complaint. Mentioned Verno, Dunwoody, and Kroenke, hinted at others, got her involved in whatever the hell she's doing, and now you say leave her out of it? Not only that, you sent me an anonymous letter with the news that she was formally investigating me for the murders. One of your mistakes, Jerry. You knew she would have no choice but to go to the police, something you were afraid of doing. Why were you afraid of the police? Maybe I don't trust the police. That's smart. So you dump me on Lacey because she has no choice but to investigate the judiciary. You knew she would go to the cops. You hid behind her, and now you want me to leave her alone, right? I don't know. How much does Lacey know? How am I supposed to know? She's in charge of her own investigation. So what did you tell her? Or I guess the question is, how much do you know? What does it matter? You'll kill me anyway. Guess what, Bannock? I caught you. He didn't respond, but returned to the files, took several, and methodically tossed them onto the fire, waiting for one to inflame before adding the next. The room was warm and smelled of smoke. The only light came from the fireplace, and shadows darkened the walls and whatever was behind her. He walked away and returned with a cup and asked, "Would you like some coffee?" "No." "Look, my ankles are breaking and my legs are numb. Cut me some slack here so we can talk, okay?" "No. And just so you'll know, there's only one door over there and it's locked. This little cabin is deep in the woods, far from anyone else. So if you feel like it, you can scream until you're hoarse. If you manage to get outside, good luck. Watch out for rattlesnakes, copperheads, bears, and coyotes, not to mention some heavily armed bubbas who don't care for people of color." "And I'm supposed to feel safer in here with you? You have no phone, wallet, money, or shoes. I left your pistol in your hotel room, but I have two hidden just over there. I prefer not to use them. Please don't." "How much does Lacey know?" Jerry stared at the fire and tried to think clearly. If she told the truth, she might endanger Lacey. But if she told the truth and convinced him that Lacey and now the FBI knew everything, he might indeed disappear. He had the means, the money, the contacts, the brains to vanish. He asked slowly, "How much does Lacey know?" "She knows what I've told her about Verno, Dunwoody, and Kroenke. Beyond that, I have no idea." "That's a lie. You obviously know about your own father, Eileen, Danny Cleveland. And you expect me to believe you haven't told Lacey?"
"I can't prove them."
"You can't prove anything. Nobody can." He reached and grabbed one strand of rope and quickly looped it around her neck. He held both ends with his hands and applied a little pressure. Jerry recoiled but couldn't get away. He was practically on top of her, his face 2 feet from hers. He hissed, "Listen to me. I want them in order. One name after the other, beginning with your father."
"Please get off me."
He pulled tighter. "Don't make me."
"Okay. Okay, my father was not the first, was he?"
"No."
"Thad Leawood was the first, then my father."
She closed her eyes and began sobbing. Loud, anguished, uncontrolled. He backed away and let the rope dangle from her neck. She buried her face in her hands and bawled until she finally caught her breath.
"I hate you," she mumbled. "You have no idea."
Who was next? She wiped her face with her forearm and closed her eyes. Ashley Barrasso, 1996. I didn't kill Ashley. That's hard to believe. Same rope, same knot. The double clove hitch you probably learned in Scouts, right, Bannock? Did Thad Leewich teach you the double clove hitch? I didn't kill Ashley. I'm in no position to argue with you. And you missed one. Good. He stood and walked to the fireplace where he tossed in some more files. When he turned his back, she yanked the rope off her neck and flung it across the room. He picked it up and returned to the stool in front of her, fiddling with the rope. Go on, he said. Who was next?
Who did I miss?
Why should I tell you?
Good point. I don't care anymore, Bannock.
Go on.
Eileen Nickelberry, 1998. How'd you find her? By digging through your past. Same for all of them. A victim is found strangled with the same rope, tied tight with a weird knot, and eventually the information gets into the FBI clearinghouse on violent crime. I know how to access it. I have some contacts. I've done it for 20 years, Bannock, and I've learned a lot. With a name, I start the research, most of which leads to dead ends. But persistence pays off. I can't believe you found me. Am I talking enough? Go on. Next. You took off a few years, a little hiatus, not unusual in your sick world, and tried to go straight. Couldn't do it. Danny Cleveland was found strangled in his home in Little Rock in 2009. He had it coming. Of course he did. Exposing corruption by good reporting should always be a capital offense. Got him. Another notch in the old belt. Go on. Next. 2 years ago, Perry Kroenke was found dead in his boat, roasting in the hot summer sun, blood everywhere. He pissed you off when you were 24, and he didn't offer you a job, like every other summer clerk. Another capital offense. You missed another. Forgive me. Go on. Verno and Dunwoody last year in Biloxi. Verno beat you in court when you were a hotshot young lawyer, so of course he deserved to die. Dunwoody showed up at the wrong time. No remorse for his family, wife, three kids, three grandkids, a wonderful man with lots of friends. Nothing whatsoever, Bannock. Anybody else? Well, that story in the ledger included Mal Schnitzer. Rather recent vintage, killed only a week ago somewhere near Houston. Seems as though your paths crossed, same as all your victims. I haven't had time to look at the Schnitzer murder. You're killing so fast these days that I can't keep up. She paused and looked at him. He was listening to her, as if amused. Keep talking, she told herself. Why is it, Bannock, that serial killers often get busy at the end? Do you read about them, the others? Are you ever curious about how they operate? Ever pick up pointers or strategies from their stories, most written after they're caught or dead, I might add? Well, I've read them all, and often. But certainly not always, because God knows there's no real method to this madness. They feel trapped and lash out by speeding up. Kroenke, then Verno and Dunwoody, now Schnitzer. That's four in just 2 years. Just three in my book. Of course, Dunwoody doesn't count because he never insulted you or pulled a gun or embarrassed you in class. Shut up. You told me to keep talking. Now I'm telling you to shut up. I don't want to, Bannock.
I've lived in your miserable life for so long, and I never dreamed I would one day be able to have a chat like this and tell you what a miserable scumbag I think you are. You're a coward. Your crimes took no courage. You said that in one of your silly poems. I thought they were rather clever. And quite stupid. Why did you bother with them? Good question, Bannock. Not sure I have the answer. I just wanted to lash out myself, I guess. Maybe as a way to torment you. I want you to suffer. And now that the end is near, I can't believe that it's you who's on the run, hiding here in the woods, planning to kill one last time. Your game is over, Bannock. So is your life. Why don't you surrender like a man and take your punishment? I said, shut up. There's so many things I want to say. Don't say them. I'm tired of your voice. If you want to talk next week, then shut up now. He abruptly stood, walked to her, sat on the stool, again with their knees almost touching. She pulled back as far as possible, certain he was about to strike. He reached for his pocket and pulled out two burner phones. I'm going to get Lacey. I want her here with you. We'll have a nice long conversation, and I'll find out how much she knows.
Leave her alone. She's done nothing but her job.
Oh, really? She's called in the FBI.
Leave her alone. Blame me, not her. She had never heard of you until I entered her life.
He showed her both phones and said, these are yours. Not sure which one will work, but I want you to call Lacey and arrange a meeting. Tell her you have a piece of evidence that will prove beyond all doubt that I'm the killer, but you can't discuss it over the phone. It's urgent, and she must meet with you now.
Just go ahead and kill me.
Listen to me, you stupid woman. I'm not going to kill you. Not now. Anyway, maybe never. I want Lacey here. We'll talk. And once I know everything, there's a good chance I'll simply disappear, go to some exotic village by the sea or in the mountains, someplace where no one speaks English. They'll never find me. I've already been there, you know? It's all planned. She breathed deeply as her heart raced. Which phone? He asked. She took one of them without looking at it. From nowhere, he produced a pistol, a rather large one, and set it beside him on the stool. You tell her to meet you at the Bayview Motel near Crestview, just off the interstate. Has she ever seen your car?
Yes.
Good. It's still there, in the parking lot. Tell her to park beside it. Your room was 232. I've reserved it for another night. In the same name of Margie Fraser, so when she checks, she'll see you're staying there. I told the manager not to clean the room. Maybe your stuff is still there.
I don't care.
Do you care about your 9mm? It was on the nightstand. I wish I'd grabbed it in time.
So do I.
There was a long pause as she stared at the fire and he stared at the floor. Slowly, he picked up the gun but did not point it at her. Make the call. You will meet her tonight at 9 at the Bayview Motel. And sell it, okay? I'm not a very good liar. Bullshit. You're a gifted liar. Just a lousy poet.
Promise me you won't hurt her.
No promises, except that if I return here without Lacey, I'll use this. He grabbed a strand of rope and tossed it on her. She shrieked and tried to slap it away. 37. The game began at 9, an awful hour to expect 10-year-old boys to be in uniform, properly stretched, warmed up, and ready to play. The Royals took the field in the top of the first, and a handful of parents clapped politely from the bleachers. A few shouted words of encouragement that the players didn't hear. The coaches clapped their hands and tried to create excitement. Diana Zhang sat alone in a lawn chair on the first base side, a quilt tucked over her legs, a tall coffee in hand. The morning air was crisp and surprisingly cool for late April in the panhandle. Across the way, down the third baseline, her ex-husband leaned on the fence and watched their child jog out to center field. Their divorce was too recent for any effort at civility. From behind her, a female voice said quietly, "Excuse me, Ms. Zhang?" She glanced to her right and confronted an officious-looking badge in a black leather wallet. A woman held it and said, "Agent Agnes Neff, FBI. Got a minute for a quick word?" Startled, like anyone would be, Diana said, "Well, I was planning to watch my son play." "So are we. Let's just move down the fence line there and have a word. Won't take 10 minutes. Diana stood and looked at the bleachers to make sure no one was watching. She turned around and saw what could only be another agent. He led the way and they stopped near the foul pole. Neff said, "This is Special Agent Drew Suarez." She shot him a look of irritation and he nodded in return. Neff continued, "We'll be brief. We're looking for your boss and can't find him. Any idea where Judge Bannock might be right now?" "Well, no. I assume he's at home on a Saturday morning." "He's not." "Well, then I don't know. What's going on?" "When did you last see him?" "He stopped by the office Thursday morning, 2 days ago. Haven't talked to him since." "We understand he's undergoing treatment." "He is. Cancer. Is he in trouble or something?" "No, not at all. We just have some routine questions regarding allegations from another investigation." That was vague enough to mean nothing, cop speak at its best, but Diana decided this was no time to push. She nodded as if she understood completely. Neff said, "So, no idea where he might be?" "I'm sure you've checked the courthouse. He has a key and comes and goes at all hours. We're watching it. He's not there. He's not at home. Any idea where else he might be?" Diana watched the game for a few seconds, not sure how much to say. "He has a bungalow at Seaside, though he rarely goes there." "We're watching it too. He's not there." "Okay. You say he's not in trouble, so why are you watching everywhere?" "We need to talk to him." "Obviously." Suarez took a step closer, gave her a hard look, and said, "Ms. Zhang, you are talking to the FBI. May I remind you, it's against the law to be untruthful." "Are you calling me a liar?"
"No."
Neff shook her head. "No," she said. "It's important that we find him as soon as possible." Diana glared at Suarez, then looked at Neff. "There's a chance he went back to Santa Fe. He's undergoing treatment there for colon cancer. Look, he's very private and makes his own travel arrangements. He's taken leave, and he doesn't discuss things with anyone." She looked at Suarez and said plainly, "Honestly, I have no idea where he is." Neff said, "He's booked no flights in the past 48 hours. As I said, I don't handle his travel." "Do you know the name of the treatment center in Santa Fe?"
"No."
Neff and Suarez looked at each other and nodded as if they believed her. Neff said, "I'd like to keep this conversation between us, okay? Off the record." Suarez chimed in with, "In other words, don't mention it to the judge should you hear from him, okay?"
"Sure."
"If you tell him about us, You might be held for aiding and abetting.
I thought you said he's done nothing wrong.
Not yet. Just keep it quiet.
Got it.
She knew only that Allie was somewhere in the Caribbean, watching, stalking, intercepting. He'd let it slip that it was a joint effort with the DEA. Something big was happening, but then she'd heard that for almost 3 years now. All that mattered was his safety, but he had been gone for 8 days with hardly a word. She was growing tired of his job, as was he, and she couldn't imagine being married to a man who was constantly disappearing. Their summit was growing closer, weeks now instead of months. The big conversation in which nothing would be held back. Complicated, yet simple. Either we commit ourselves to each other and a different future, or we call it quits and stop wasting time. She was in pain, stretching in some form of mixed yoga and physical therapy, a 30-minute routine she was supposed to check off twice a day when the phone rang at 10:04. Probably Jerry, looking for an update. Instead, it was the not-too-pleasant voice of Clay Vidovich, her new pal from yesterday at the FBI meeting in Pensacola. "Sorry to bother on a Saturday morning," he went on, but didn't really seem concerned with the interruption. "We can't find this guy, Lacey," he said. "You have any ideas?"
"Well, no, Mr. Vidovich. It's Clay, okay? I thought we dropped the formalities yesterday."
"Right, Clay. I don't know this guy, never met him, so I have no idea where he hangs out. Sorry."
"Does he know you're involved, that BJC is investigating?"
"We haven't contacted him directly. We're not required to until after our initial assessment, but he probably knows about us."
"How would he?"
"Well, Betty Rowe, our source, believes Bannett can see around corners and hears everything. So far, she's been right most of the time. Anytime you investigate a judge, the gossip seems to leak out. People love to talk, especially lawyers and court clerks, so yes, there's a decent chance Bannett knows we're investigating."
"But he would not know that you've gone to the state police and the FBI."
"Clay, I have no idea what Bannett knows."
"Good point. Look, I'm not trying to ruin your Saturday morning or anything, but are you somewhere safe?"
Lacey looked around her condo, looked at her dog, looked at her front door, certain that it was locked.
"Sure. I'm at home. Why?
Are you alone?"
"Now you're prying."
"Okay, I'm prying. But I'd be remiss if I didn't say that we'd feel better if you were not alone, at least until we find him."
"You're serious?"
"Dead serious, Lacey. This guy, a sitting judge, has simply vanished in the past 36 hours. He could be anywhere, and he could be dangerous. We'll find him, but until then, I think you should take precautions."
"I'll be okay."
"Sure you will. Please call if you hear anything."
"Will do."
She stared at her phone as she walked to the door and checked the lock. It was a gorgeous spring morning, cool with no clouds, and she had planned to shop at her favorite nursery and plant some azaleas in her flower beds. She scolded herself for being frightened on such a perfect day. Allie was off playing cop. Darren had taken a new girlfriend to the beach for a getaway. She walked around the condo, checking doors and windows, still scolding. To relax, she lowered herself to her yoga mat and folded into a child's pose. After two deep breaths, her phone buzzed again, startling her. Why was she so jumpy? It was the third man in her life, and she was not unhappy to hear Gunther's voice. He apologized for missing her weekly call the previous Tuesday. Of course, it was all because of a critical development meeting with his new team of architects. She stretched out on the sofa and they chatted for a long time, both admitted to being bored. Gunther's current girl?
if indeed he had a serious one, was away too. Once he realized that Lacey had nothing planned for the afternoon, he was even more animated and finally mentioned lunch. It had been only 2 weeks since their last one, and the fact that he was so eager to fly down again this soon was disheartening. More than likely, he was one step away from the bankers, and they were closing in fast. He said, "I'm an hour from the airport, and the flight takes about 80 minutes. Want to say 2 p.m?" Sure. As troublesome as he was, it would be comforting to have him around, at least for the next 24 hours. She would convince him to stay for dinner, then sleep over, and at some point they would have no choice but to talk about her lawsuit. It might be a relief to get that conversation out of the way. 38. The first two calls went unanswered, which was not unusual, especially on a Saturday. He nodded, said, "Try again." "Could you please put the gun down?" she asked.
"No."
He just sat there, 5 feet away, his back to the fire, with the 30-inch section of nylon rope draped around his collar and falling harmlessly to his chest. "Try again." She had lost all feeling in her ankles and feet, and maybe that was a good thing. They were numb, so if they were broken, the pain could not be felt, but the numbness was radiating up her legs and she felt paralyzed. She had asked to use the restroom. He said no. She had not moved in hours and had no idea of the time. On the third call, Lacey answered. "Lacey? Hi, it's Jerry. How are you, dear?" She sang as cheerily as humanly possible with a 6-inch barrel watching every move. He raised the gun a few inches. They went back and forth with the weather, the beautiful spring day, then got down to business with the FBI's futile search for Bannock. "They'll never find him," Jerry said, staring into Bannock's soulless eyes. She closed her own and launched into the fiction. An anonymous informant had given her clear physical proof that would nail Bannock. She couldn't discuss it on the phone. They needed to meet, and it was urgent. She was hiding in a motel 2 hours away, and she didn't care what was planned for the evening. Cancel it. She said, "My car is in the lot on the south side of the motel. Park next to it. I'll be watching. And Lacey, please come alone. Is that possible?" "Sure. There's no danger, right?" "No more than usual." The conversation was brief, and when she hung up, Bannock actually smiled. "See? You are a gifted liar." She handed him the burner and said, "Please give me the dignity of going to the bathroom." He put away the gun and the phone and reached to unlock her ankle chains and cuffs. He tried to help her stand, but she pushed him away, her first contact made in anger. "Just give me a minute, okay?" She stood for a moment as the blood rushed to her feet and lower legs, and the pain returned in hot bolts. He handed her a walking cane, which she took to steady herself. She was tempted to crack him with it, to strike at least one blow for all the victims, but she wasn't balanced enough. Besides, he would easily subdue her, and the aftermath wouldn't be pretty. She shuffled into a small bedroom where he waited with the pistol as she managed to lock the door to a closet-style bathroom with no tub or shower, and no window. The dim light barely worked. She relieved herself and sat on the toilet for a long time, so content to be locked away from him. Content? She was a dead woman and she knew it. Now, what had she done to Lacey? She flushed again, though it wasn't necessary. Anything to stall. He finally tapped on the door and said, "Let's go. Time's up." In the bedroom, he nodded at the bed and said, "You can rest in here. I'll be right in there. That window is locked, and it won't open anyway. Do anything stupid, and you know what will happen." She almost thanked him, but caught herself and stretched out on the bed. It was the perfect time and place for a sexual assault, but she wasn't worried. Evidently, it never crossed his mind. Though the cabin was warm, she pulled a dusty blanket over herself anyway and was soon sleepy. It was the fatigue, the fear, and probably the remnants of his drugs still racing through her body. When she was asleep, he popped a Benny and tried to stay awake. Always eager to show off for a pretty girl, even for his sister, Gunther had the idea of flying off to lunch and dining on great seafood. He claimed that all small aircraft pilots in that part of the world were familiar with Beau Willie's oysters on a bayou near Houma, Louisiana. A 4,000-foot airstrip was surrounded by water on three sides and made for white-knuckle landings. Once on the ground, the restaurant was a 10-minute walk. During the day, most of the customers were pilots out looking for fun and good food. When they landed and got out of the plane, Lacey checked her phone. Jerry had called twice. Seconds later, she called again, and they chatted as she followed her brother to Beau Willie's. Though the call was somewhat mysterious, the news was breathtaking. Clear proof that would nail Bannock. Her appetite vanished, but she managed to choke down half a dozen raw oysters as she watched Gunther gorge on a dozen for starters and then attack a fried oyster po' boy. They talked about Aunt Trudy and got that out of the way. He quizzed her about any news on the alley front and again offered too much advice. It was time for her to find a husband and start a family and forget the notion of going through life alone. She reminded him that he was perhaps the last person she would listen to when the subject was long-term commitments. That was always good for a laugh, and Gunther was a sport about it. She asked about his current flame, and he seemed as disinterested as he'd been 2 weeks earlier. "Got a question," she said as she sipped iced tea. Gunther had toyed with the idea of a cold beer, even said he had never eaten oysters without one, but he was, after all, flying a plane. "Anything. I just got a call that sort of changes my plans. There's a town called Crestview, about an hour east of Pensacola, population 20,000. I need to meet an important witness there at 9 tonight. Would it be possible to land there and rent a car?" "Probably. Any town of that size will have an airport. What's going on?" "It's big." She glanced around. They were on a deck at the edge of the water and the other tables were empty. It was almost 5 p.m. on a Saturday, too late for lunch and too early for dinner. The bar was crowded with locals drinking beer. "Last time I mentioned that we're investigating a judge who might be involved in a murder." "Sure, not one of your run-of-the-mill cases." "Hardly. Well, the call came from our star witness, and she says she has some important information. I need to see her."
"In Crestview?"
"Yes. It's on the way home. Could we stop there?" "I guess I'm not going back to Atlanta tonight." "Please, it would be a big favor. Plus, I'd like to have someone with me." Gunther pulled out his smartphone and went online. "No problem. They say they have rentals. This could be dangerous."
"I doubt it, but a little caution might be in order." "I love it.
And this is strictly confidential, Gunther." He laughed and looked around. "And who might I tell?"
"Just keep it between us."
He stood in the dark room beside her bed and listened to her heavy breathing. His instincts told him to take the rope dangling from his left hand and finish her off. It would be the easiest one of all. He could do it quickly, effortlessly, then wipe down the cabin and drive away. It would be days before she was found. On the one hand, he hated her for what she had done to him.
she had brought down his world, and his life would never be the same. She and she alone had stalked him, tracked him, and now his game was over. But on the other hand, he couldn't help but admire her pluck, brains, and doggedness. This woman had done better work than 100 cops in several states, and now he was on the run. He tossed the rope onto the bed, took a microfiber cloth wet with ether, and held it onto her face. As she jerked, he clasped one arm around her neck and held the cloth as tightly as possible with his hand. She fought and kicked, but was no match. A minute passed, and she began to go limp. When she was still, he released his grip and put away the cloth. Slowly, methodically, he took a hypodermic needle and poked it into her arm. 500 milligrams of ketamine, enough to keep her out several hours. He toyed with the idea of another dose, but it was risky. Too much, and she might never wake up. If he had to kill her, he preferred doing it the proper way. He walked into the other room, tossed some more files onto the fire, picked up the handcuffs and ankle chains, and took them to the bed, where he pinned her wrists tightly behind her back and locked the cuffs. He secured her ankles with the chains and, for fun, wrapped the nylon rope lightly around her neck. As always, he was wearing plastic gloves, but for good measure, he wiped down the surfaces anyway. He checked the windows again and could not open them. It was an old cabin and in bad repair, and the windows had been locked by dried paint and disuse. He burned the last of the files, and when he was certain the fire was safe, he locked the cabin's only door, stepped onto the porch, and checked his watch. 7:10. He was about an hour north of Crestview, near Gant Lake in Alabama. The dirt trail wound through the woods with only an occasional glimpse of the lake. It passed a drive here and there, but the other cabins were not visible. He turned onto a gravel road and waved at two scruffy teenagers on ATVs. They stopped to watch him go by. He preferred not to be seen by anyone and debated returning to the cabin just to make sure the kids were not curious. He let it pass, called it paranoia. The gravel eventually yielded to a paved county road, and he was soon on a state highway, headed south. 39. It was dark when Lacey spotted the white Camry in the motel's lot. As instructed by Jerry, she parked her rental next to it and got out. Gunther did not. She entered the lobby a few minutes early and loitered in the gift shop looking at postcards for sale. At 9:01, Gunther entered from a side door and said hello to the receptionist. Lacey took the elevator to the second floor. Gunther took the stairs. The hallway was short, about 10 rooms on each side, and a red exit sign glowed at the far end. She stopped at the door to room 232 and took a deep breath. She knocked 3 times, and at that moment, all the lights went out. Across the hall, Bannock used his laptop to turn off the lights and security cameras. He tossed it on the bed, grabbed a cloth with ether, and opened his door. Lacey heard him and turned around just as he lunged for her in the darkness. She managed to yell, "Hey!" before her brother charged from nowhere in the pitch blackness and bowled over them. All 3 fell into a pile. Lacey screamed and scrambled to her feet while Bannock flailed away at his attacker. He landed a kick somewhere near his ribs, and Gunther grunted. Both men punched and grappled violently at each other as Lacey ran to the end of the hall screaming. Someone opened a door and yelled, "Hey, what's going on? Call the police," Lacey said. Bannock landed a kick in the face, and Gunther was stunned. He crawled away, grabbing at anything, finding nothing. Bannock
ducked into his room, got his laptop, and disappeared toward the exit. Lacey and Gunther found the stairs and hustled down one flight to the dark lobby. The receptionist had a flashlight and was saying to some guests, I don't know. Same thing happened last night. Call the police, Lacey said. We were attacked on the second floor.
Who attacked you?
That's a long story, Lacey thought, but said, hell if I know. Hurry, he's getting away. More flashlights appeared from behind the desk as more guests stumbled down in the dark. Gunther found a chair and took a seat to nurse his wounds. Son of a bitch can kick like a mule, he said, still dazed. I think my ribs are broken. Lacey sat next to him as things settled down and they waited for the police. She said, I have to call Jerry. I think she's in trouble. Who's Jerry?
Betty Rowe, our girl, the source. I'll explain later.
Jerry did not answer her phone, which was not at all unusual. Lacey scrolled through her recent calls and punched the number for Clay Vidovich. He answered after the second ring, and she told him where she was, what had happened, and said she was certain they had been set up by Ross Bannock. She could not positively identify him, but everything added up. He was in the process of fleeing the area. No, she did not see what he was driving. Vidovich was having dinner with his team in downtown Pensacola, an hour away. He would notify the Florida State Police and get the authorities in Mobile to check on Jerry. Lacey was certain they would not find her there. Vidovich was headed her way and told Lacey to inform the motel not to touch the two rooms. Moments later, the local police arrived with blue lights flashing. They found the lobby in chaos as guests milled about in the semi-darkness. The motel's lighting smart panel and security grid had been hacked, and no one on the skeletal staff knew what to do. Lacey explained as much as she could and gave a general description of Bannock. No, she had no idea what he was driving. They, too, called the state police, but with no description of the vehicle, they were not sure where to begin. A clerk appeared with two small bags of ice, one for Gunther's ribs, the other for his jaw, which was swollen but probably not broken. He was still a bit groggy, and breathing was painful, but he refused to complain and wanted to get back to his airplane. A janitor rigged up a portable gas generator, and suddenly the lobby was lit. There was not enough voltage for air conditioning, and the temperature rose fast. Several of the guests spilled into the parking lot and loitered around their vehicles. He fought the urge to race down the state highway and kept his speed close to the limit. Overreacting would only cause more trouble, and he willed himself to drive reasonably while he thought through what had just happened. He had been ambushed for the first time in his career, and he was certain he'd made mistakes. But he still wore plastic gloves and knew he'd left behind no prints, no evidence. He had entered the room with only a smartphone and a laptop, and both were now at the bottom of a pond outside of Crestview. His right shoulder ached from the fight, or whatever it could be called. He never saw the man, never heard him coming. He had his hands on Lacey for only a second before being tackled and knocked down. Then she started screaming. It was probably Darren Trope, her colleague, son of a bitch. He soon crossed into Alabama, took a detour, and drove through the Conecuh National Forest. As he approached the town of Andalusia, population 9,000, he decided to circle around it. It was almost 10:30 on a Saturday night, and the cops would be out in force. He didn't need a GPS because he had memorized the highways and roads. He saw the signs for Gant Lake and zigzagged his way in its direction. He drove through the quiet village of Antioch without seeing another human, and the roads narrowed. Less than 2 miles from his next turn onto a gravel road, he was shocked to see blue lights bearing down from behind. His speedometer was at 50, the limit, and he knew he had not been speeding. There were no traffic lights to run through. He slowed even more and gawked at the county patrol car as it flew past. Saturday night, probably a brawl in a honky-tonk. The blue lights disappeared in front of him. He would kill her quickly and be on his way. The cabin was clean, no clues as always. He would decorate the job with a perfect knot, only fitting since she was so curious about it. The gravel road ran deeper into the woods, into the darkness where the cabin waited. Suddenly, there were more blue lights. Another county boy, hot on his trail. He slowed almost to a stop and got out of the way. The car slid past, missing his by inches, a boiling cloud of dust in its wake. Something wasn't right. He turned onto the dirt trail that ended at the cabin's front door, so deep in the woods it could not be seen by anyone passing by. He saw a clearing with a gap in the fence and pulled off the road. He backed into some undergrowth, got out, and jogged toward the cabin. Around a bend, he saw a terrible sight. The cabin was a scene, with cops and blue lights everywhere. The two boys, ages 15 and 16, had arrived on ATVs before dark. They noticed the smoke from the chimney and knew someone was there for the weekend, but the Silver Tahoe had just left. They watched the cabin, watched the road, and waited until long after dark before kicking in the front door. They were looking for guns, fishing gear, anything of value. They found nothing but a dead black woman lying on the bed, her wrists cuffed behind her, her ankles chained together. They panicked, fled, and didn't stop until they wheeled into a country store closed for the evening. They called 911 from a payphone and reported a dead woman in the old Sutton cabin off Crab Hill Road. When the dispatcher asked their names, they hung up and hurried home. Jerry was taken by ambulance to a regional hospital in Enterprise, Alabama. She was awake, severely nauseated, dehydrated, and still not lucid, but recovering quickly. At midnight, she was talking to the state police and filling in the gaps. She had been drugged so much by Bannock that she had not seen his vehicle, so there was no description. A quick search, though, gave the police his make, model, and license plates. At 1 a.m., a detective called Lacey's number. She was at home in Tallahassee, safe, and tending to her brother, who had been x-rayed and given painkillers. The detective smiled, handed his phone to Jerry, and when they heard each other's voices, they burst into tears. By then, he was cruising into Birmingham with fake Texas tags on his Tahoe. He parked in the long-term lot at the international airport and, carrying his overnight bag, entered the main terminal. He sipped an espresso at a coffee bar and killed time. He found a row of seats with a view of the runways and tried to nap. Just another weary traveler. When the Avis counter opened at 6, he ambled over and chatted with the clerk. Using a fake driver's license and a prepaid credit card issued to an alias, he rented a Honda, one with California tags, and left the airport, headed west. Far west. For the next 20 hours, he would drive virtually nonstop, pay cash for gas, pop bennies, and slug endless cups of black coffee. 40. At 7:30 Sunday morning, two teams of FBI agents and technicians, backed up by locals, crashed into Bannock's world. The first entered his home with a crowbar and disarmed his security systems, but not before arousing the neighbors. The second entered the Chavez County Courthouse with the assistance of Diana Zhang and a janitor and began combing through his desk, file cabinets, bookshelves, anything he might have touched. They quickly realized the file cabinets were empty, as were his desk drawers. Diana was surprised to see so many of his personal items missing, framed photos and awards and certificates, letter openers, pens, writing pads, paperweights. She went to her desk to look for files he had dealt with and found the drawers empty. His desktop computer could not be accessed, and its hard drive was missing. It was taken to a van to be shipped to a lab. In his home, the technicians found a refrigerator that was virtually empty, as were all garbage cans. Piles of clothing and towels had been washed and tossed on the bed. In the small office, they found no phones or laptops. This desktop, too, could not be accessed and was hauled out. Its hard drive was gone. The searches would take hours, if not days, but it was soon apparent that his home and his office in the courthouse had been thoroughly wiped. After 2 hours of powdering the obvious surfaces, not a single latent print had been identified. But the technicians labored on methodically, and confident that they would find prints. It was impossible to live and work in an area for years and not leave something behind. Jerry was discharged at noon. She was still suffering from nausea and couldn't eat, but there was nothing else the doctors could do but ply her with meds. Her head ached, and the ibuprofen did little to ease the throbbing. Her wrists and ankles were numb, but slowly growing more sensitive. She had talked to Denise twice and assured her that she was safe and healthy, and there was no need for her to rush down. She set off with two escorts, both young and rather cute FBI agents, one the driver, the other in the back seat, doing most of the talking. However, she was not in a glib mood, and after a few miles, they left her alone. She stared through the passenger window, reliving the past 48 hours, still in disbelief that she was alive. And Bannock had not been found. She had believed for a long time that the man was capable of anything, especially moving in the shadows without being detected. He had boasted of vanishing to some faraway place. As the miles clicked by and the hours passed, a horrible reality began to consume her. What if he walked away and was never brought to justice, and his monstrous crimes were never solved? What if her lonely quest to find her father's killer was for nothing? Mobile was out of the question. He had been to her home, rang her doorbell, knew exactly where she lived. He had tracked her to the motel and abducted her without being seen or leaving behind a clue, as always. She wondered if she could ever go home. 2 hours later, they entered Tallahassee and were soon winding through downtown. When they stopped at the renovated warehouse, Lacey was waiting on her stoop. She and Jerry hugged and cried and eventually went inside. Allie had returned a few hours earlier and had been debriefed by Lacey and by Gunther, who relished his role as the hero. Lacey had little doubt that as the story was told and retold, his fearless attack of a serial killer would only be embellished and become legendary. Lacey asked one of the agents to go fetch a pizza. The other sat by the door, guarding the place. Inside, the four lounged in the den and swapped stories. Eventually, they found humor, especially when Gunther, always animated, stopped mid-sentence to clutch his ribs. His swollen jaw did not throttle his narratives. For her own benefit, Jerry recounted her conversations with Bannock. He had not explicitly admitted to any of the murders, but had grudgingly acquiesced to parts of her narrative. He denied killing Ashley Barrasso, though that seemed hardly credible. More troubling were his assertions that he had killed others that Jerry had missed. At 5, they arrived at the FBI office in the federal building. Clay Vidovich welcomed them, and they settled around a table in the main conference room. The big news was that they had recovered 2 latent prints from Bannock's garage. The bad news was that they were not from his thumb. He was confident, though, that they would find more prints, but admitted they were taken aback by Bannock's efforts to wipe everything clean. His cell phone had stopped working in Crestview. He'd probably tossed it. No one named Ross Bannock had booked a flight in the past 72 hours. His secretary had not heard a word. He had no family in the area, only a sister who lived far away and had had no contact. Nonetheless, Vidovich was certain they would find him. A nationwide manhunt was in full swing, and it was only a matter of time. Jerry wasn't so sure, but kept her thoughts to herself. When she finally relaxed, she began talking about the past 2 days. She was not feeling well, though, and promised a longer debriefing on Monday. Thank God someone broke into the cabin. 41. He stopped in Amarillo long enough to leave an overnight FedEx envelope in a drop box. He was the sender and used his office address at the Chavez County Courthouse. The recipient was Diana Zhang at the same address. If everything went as planned, it would be picked up by 5 Monday afternoon and delivered to her by 10:30 Tuesday morning. At 8 a.m. Monday, he parked the rental outside Pecos Mountain Lodge and took a moment to admire the beautiful mountains in the distance. The high-end rehab facility was tucked into a hillside and hardly visible from the winding county road. He changed gloves and wiped down the steering wheel, door handles, console, and media screen. He had worn gloves for the past 20 hours and knew the car was clean, but he took no chances. With his small bag, he walked inside the plush lobby and said good morning to the receptionist. "I have an appointment with Dr. Joseph Kasabian," he said politely. "And your name, please?"
"Bannock. Ross Bannock."
"Please have a seat and I'll get him." He sat on a sleek leather sofa and admired the contemporary art on the walls. At $50,000 a month, the wealthy drunk certainly deserved pleasant surroundings. Pecos was kept busy by rock stars, Hollywood types, and jet-setters, and in spite of being so well-known, it prided itself on keeping a low profile. Its challenge with confidentiality was that so many of its former patients couldn't wait to sing its praises. Dr. Kasabian soon appeared, and they retired to his office down the hall. He was about 50, a former addict.
"Aren't we all?" he'd said on the phone.
They sat at a small table and sipped designer water. "Tell me your story," he said with a warm, welcoming smile. "Your nightmare is over. You've come to the right place." Bannock wiped his face with his hands and seemed ready to cry. "It's all booze, no drugs. Vodka, at least a quart a day for many years now. I can function okay. I'm a judge, and the job is demanding, but I gotta quit the stuff." "That's a lot of vodka." "It's never enough, and it's getting worse. That's why I'm here."
"When was your last drink?"
3 days ago. I've always managed to quit for short periods, but I can't kick the stuff. It's killing me."
"So you probably don't need detox."
"I don't think so.
I've done this before, Doctor. This is my third rehab in the past 5 years. I'd like to stay for a month.
How long were your other rehabs?
A month?
30 days won't do it, Mr. Bannock. Trust me on this. 30 days will get you dried out and feeling great, but you need at least 60. 90 is our recommended stay.
I guess so, at $50,000 a month.
Maybe. Right now, I'm just praying for 30 days. Just get me sober. Please.
We'll do that. We're very good at what we do. Trust us.
Thank you.
I'll introduce you to our admissions director, who'll do the paperwork and such. Do you have insurance, or will it be private pay?
Private. I have assets, doctor.
Even better.
Okay. Look, I'm an elected official, so confidentiality is a prime concern. No one can know I'm here. I'm single, no family, a few friends, but I've told no one. Not even my secretary.
Dr. Kasabian smiled because he heard it all the time. Believe me, Mr. Bannock, we understand confidentiality.
What's in the bag?
A few items, clothing, a toothbrush. I brought no phone, no laptop, no devices.
Good.
In about a week, you can use the phone. Nothing until then.
I know. Not my first rodeo.
I understand, but I'll need to take the bag and inventory it. We provide nice linen gowns, Ralph Lauren for the first 2 weeks.
Sure.
You bring a car?
It's a rental. I flew in.
Okay. After the paperwork, we'll do a complete physical. That'll take most of the morning. You and I will have lunch together, just the two of us, and talk about the past and the future. Then I'll introduce you to your counselor.
Bannock nodded, as if thoroughly defeated.
Dr. Kasabian said, I'm glad you came in sober. It's a good start. You wouldn't believe some of the poor folks who stagger in here.
I don't feel sober, doctor, anything but.
You're in the right place. They walked next door and met the director of admissions. Bannock paid the first $10,000 with a credit card and signed a promissory note for the other $40,000. Dr. Kasabian kept his bag. When the admission was complete, he was shown to his rather spacious room on the second floor. Dr. Kasabian excused himself and said he was looking forward to lunch. When Bannock was finally alone, he quickly took off his stylish nylon tactical travel belt and removed small plastic bags from its hidden pockets. The bags contained 2 sets of pills that would be needed later. He hid them under a chest of drawers. A steward knocked on his door and handed him a stack of gowns and towels. He waited until Bannock undressed in the bathroom, then left with his clothing, including the belt and his shoes. He showered, put on one of the soft linen gowns, stretched out on the bed, and fell asleep. Lacey, Jerry, and Allie dropped Gunther off at the airport and watched him taxi out and take off. When he was in the air, they felt like celebrating. They returned to the FBI office and met with Clay Vidovich and 2 other agents. Jerry signed an affidavit that recited the facts of her weekend encounter with Bannock. A warrant for kidnapping was issued and circulated nationally, everywhere but the Pensacola area. They were certain Bannock was not hanging around the panhandle and did not want to alert his friends and acquaintances. Vidovich gave them an update on the searches of his office and home and was bothered by the fact that no more prints had been found. The FBI was searching his real estate holdings, but so far had found nothing.